The Farming the Countryside podcast is brought to you by Pivot BioProven. Get what you paid for. The nitrogen that stays put, whether or not. Learn more at pivotbio.com. Welcome to Farming the Countryside. I'm Andrew McCray. Corn planting season will soon be here. In fact, if you are in the southern U.S., you might even have done some field work or have seeds in the ground. Ken Ferry is a well-known expert when it comes to growing great corn. We talk about what 2019 taught him to do in 2020 and many more insights from his years of experience. And in the second half of the show, I visit with Mark Faust with Echelon Marketing. He works with many companies, including those in agriculture, and is known for helping business leaders think more strategically. Learn the steps he says each of us need to think about in order to be better in business. It's all on this edition of Farming the Countryside. Ken Ferry has long been an expert when it comes to getting the most out of your corn crop. He consults with many farmers via his company, Crop Tech Consulting, in Hayworth, Illinois. I always learn a lot from what Ken has seen in many cornfields across the country. And although he's seen a lot, he certainly sees new things each year. We discussed how to use those things within our control to deal with conditions that are sometimes out of our control. Here's our conversation. Ken, obviously we came through a year that was one that we will remember for a while. What did you learn new coming out of this year since you've been doing it so long? Were there some things that you picked up from a year that was not the best in a lot of places?
You know, some of the things that I learned was the value of technology on the planter. We teach a class, I guess you would say, with our customers on how to teach the planter to dance, and the technology to do that has really changed. When we think about the closing systems, the downforce, and main thing is monitoring it, so know what you're doing. And we were able to plant corn in what I would call marginal conditions that just 5 years ago, just flat, would have been too wet. You know, the concept of being able to lift up on a row unit so you can keep a real light footprint when you're out there planting, it literally allowed guys to plant corn 2 weeks earlier than they would have, or if they were using the old technology, we would have had slots open, stuff like that. So some of this technology was a game changer this year when we got all put under the gun as far as how we're going to get this crop in and get it in right.
Talk about some of that technology specifically. Is it things like smart firmers? Is it on-the-go technology that's allowing us to know how much depth to plant out, how much down pressure, so forth?
It starts with the technology that's doing the sensing. So, yes, smart firmers looking at moisture and temperature, that type of thing, but also we're looking at how much downforce is actually applied, not only on the planter, but per row, per foot, as we're moving across that planter. And that gives the operator some comfort. So when he's in there and he's deciding, am I getting good seed-to-soil contact? Am I maintaining depth? Now he has sensors that can tell him that. And he can change his downforce, he can change his speed, he can change his planter settings, but he can dial himself in. Where it used to be, you made a round, got out, dug, made a round, got out, and dug, and you spent half a day digging behind the planter trying to decide, is this planter doing what I think it should be doing? The technology that tells him it is or it isn't, he still has to get out and dig, verify the monitors and stuff. But that was huge. And then for him to actually sit there and be able to take downforce off a row unit till that point where he's not getting good contact, and then he can come back and add to it. So this year, typically we say if you're going to err on the side of too much. With the technology today, though, if you want to plant in those marginal conditions, you got to be very careful when you add too much. So part of it in monitoring, the other part of giving him options, and that planter is being smart to be able to make those adjustments going across the field. Our window to get that job done this year was a lot tighter. So the days that we had, the good running days, and, you know, typically for us, we had 4 days in April. We had 5 days in May, and the rest was in June. Well, if you can take a high-speed planter and double your output in those days, you get a lot more acres in than what, you know, than what we would have before that technology showed up.
In many places, we had a late good fall. It seemed like it was warm. We had good conditions. So as you look back at the planting dates, what did we learn about that? Were we just as well off in June as we were April this year, or what did you find? These hybrids seem to have a little more flexibility now.
So the hybrids definitely have changed over time. I'm an advocate to tell you that today, I think, with today's genetics, we got about a month to plant corn. So it used to be if you, you know, in Illinois, if you got past April 15th, you started to get nervous and you wanted it in the ground by April 20th. I think today we have to say you just got to put it in good conditions. If you mud corn in and the slot opens up on you, you're going to get clipped no matter what the calendar says. So you got to be patient and look for that window. We can get by with a little bit of that in soybeans, meaning that the soybean doesn't have such a rough start that it's going to show up through the whole year where corn does. We saw in a lot of cases the June planted corn out yielding both May and April corn because we mudded some of that April May corn in and it spent 2 weeks getting out of the ground and the tough conditions that we had. Now at the same time we had a phenomenal finish. So if we wouldn't have had a phenomenal finish, we'd have saw some pretty depressing yields from the June planted corn that we got to keep in mind. But the trend has been to get a pretty decent September, so it's kind of changed over the last 5 to 10 years. Some of our growers ran out of water in July and August, and it crippled all the corn they planted, but really caught their June planted corn. So not everybody saw the same success, but where you're able to keep the crop alive through the season and then take advantage of the phenomenal September we had, it's pretty surprising when you see these 250-60 bushel yields coming out of June 10th planted corn.
We've talked about the technology quite a bit here. Is it more important than ever then that farmers are putting that technology on a planter, or can I still get by with some of the old techniques, but I just monitor it really well and make it happen?
You know, up until this year, I would say, yeah, if you're a student behind that planter digging and really paying attention, you can maybe replace some of this technology with boots on the ground experience. My opinion, I guess, has changed after this year. When I saw what we could do, because we got to fields that 80% of that field was marginal and 10% really shouldn't be planted, and the planter was able to make adjustments on the go to make it a nice stand even in the marginal and tough conditions. It was making those adjustments as far as downforce and that stuff is concerned. So I think the technology has now went beyond what we could do even behind that planter. Now if it's beautiful planting conditions and it's May 10th and you're out there checking the soil moisture and everything else, that's a different condition. But when you're up against it, either being too wet like we were this year or maybe even some years too dry, having the technology to identify that when you're going through the field on a live basis, I think is probably really changed the whole planting window.
I specifically wanted to ask you about one piece of technology. We now on some planters can do variable hybrids. So we plant certain hybrids, offensive, defensive. Was this a year that was really hard to do that because the weather was so different? Or is that still good technology to be putting a certain hybrid on certain soils and another one on others?
So multi-hybrid or changing hybrid as we go through the field, based on our research, I still believe is the next slow rabbit to shoot. It's the next place to bump yields without adding cost, adding time, adding effort, that type of thing. It is a little tricky, though, because we got so much to learn about the hybrids and their characteristics and what they're doing. And a year like this makes it a real trick because you have your plan laid out what you're going to do. And then if you get late enough and you're forced to change genetics, now you're forced into genetics you may not know anything about. And it kind of takes away from that technology at that point. If you have a wider range of genetics, so you pre-plan to say, well, here's the genetics I would go to if I'm planting in June, and you learn about those genetics, you could be prepared ahead of time. But it takes a lot of effort to learn your hybrids and decide what do I think is going to be the best hybrid for the soil conditions that we're faced out there.
What did we also learn about nitrogen this past year? Certainly anhydrous is still something a lot of folks are going to go with. It was hard to get it on last fall and even this spring. We've got a lot of new products out there that we can put on the spring dry, both at planting and then later on. What did you find out there in fields?
Well, kind of same old as far as when we look at, and we got to have enough to keep that corn plant happy at every stage of its life. So no matter how you apply it, for instance, if you're applying large amounts in the spring, and that you have adequate supply to keep you happy through the rest of the year, you're not going to pick up a yield advantage to splitting that N rate. But if you can't hold that N, and that's what happened with our fall applied nitrogen this year and our March early April applied weed and feed. When it went all in one shot, we had too much time between there and the June planting, and now we're talking July before the corn crop can catch it, and our losses were too high. So that's, you know, where we took a beating in the end. We just didn't have enough horsepower to punch it out at the end. So you got one neighbor cranking on 250 bushel corn, and the next guy's 180 and can't figure out why he ran out. As I drove across the Midwest this summer, shortly after tasseling, you saw a lot of fields running out of N, and most of those were fields with a one-shot program in the spring. It was just too much water thrown at it. And unfortunately, when you run out of N coming into tasseling, you can't take advantage of the September that we had because you just don't have any horsepower left to get depth of kernel. And there was a lot of money left on the table by not paying attention to the N management. And they didn't do anything different they would do in any other year. It's just that they threw a tremendous lot of water at their N program and didn't have a crop there to pick it up. And that crop was a month and a half behind.
So as we look at this next year ahead then, are there any dangers having come through this year that we overcompensate some ways for this year that we just had? How should we look at this upcoming year as we get ready to plant?
Well, you know, we think about some of the sins of 2019. So there was a number of fields that did get worked wet and compaction got put in. Some fields got sprayed wet, so our post-spray applications left ruts in the field, stuff like that. And these all become problems for the corn planter next spring, and they're going to become problems for the summer growth. If the compaction layer is severe enough, it'll turn roots. So we have to think about, you know, what did we do this year, and how does it change next year? Now, if you did tillage this fall and you tore all that back out, it's probably, you know, you're back to square one. It's not a big issue. For a lot of guys that are still finishing up this crop, you know, the situation, well, what are we going to do with the volunteer corn? And because a lot of this corn is struggling now to hold its ears and stay up. So if we're combining December corn, we really should prepare a plan to how we're going to manage the volunteer corn next year's crop.
Let's wind up with this. We've not talked much about beans. Talk about the season that we had. In a lot of places, at least where I farm, the bean crop was one of the best ever. You know, you could get away with planting in June, and we had the nice fall. It really paid off.
Yeah, we saw, I would say, better bean yields than most farmers expected for planting in June. In a lot of cases, they were within, in our area anyway, they were within 5-6 bushel of APHs. And being the fact that they're planted more like a double crop bean, that was pretty impressive. And as you looked at the pod counts weren't that impressive, but most of the horsepower came in bean size. And that, again, tells us that the last inning of the game was where we won it, meaning that R5 through R6 window. We just pumped up this bean size. So might create some issues with seed beans when we talk about the size of the seed beans for next year. But at the same time, we made this bean crop at the very end of the season. So again, as we tell guys, never give up on a growing crop. You stay on top of it, whether it's insects or disease, because you don't know when you're going to get thrown an opportunity to put that yield back in there.
I always enjoy talking with Kent. We'll try to catch up with him again as we get into the growing season. We need to take a break. Farming the Countryside is sponsored by Pivot BioProven. Everyone knows that plants need nitrogen to grow, and now there's a way to make sure corn plants have the nitrogen they need every day. Synthetic nitrogen is susceptible to loss, and applying mid-season can be time-consuming and costly if you can even get in the field at all. Pivot BioProven's nitrogen-producing microbes bond tightly to corn roots, transferring ammonia to the corn plant each day. Unlike synthetic nitrogen, Pivot BioProven is not washed away, making crop yields more productive and more predictable. Pivot BioProven, nitrogen that stays put, weather or not. Every business requires good decision-making to survive and thrive. Are there keys that the best business leaders use to consistently make great decisions? How can you think more strategically when you lead? Mark Faust with Echelon Marketing in Cincinnati, Ohio, has those answers and more. He works with many businesses, including agricultural operations, to help them find more success. I caught up with him at a recent ag conference, and we sat down to get his ideas on what he sees as the best practices to put in place. Mark, first of all, just tell people a little bit about your background, because you are working with businesses, individuals, on what I would consider leadership and business principles, but talk about your background for just a moment.
I spent a few years in consulting right out of school. Met my first boss, actually, in a class, even though he was a 50-year-old national consulting, HR consulting executive. And then he helped me start my company in 1990. I interviewed a variety of turnaround CEOs, and they gave me the tools along with what Peter Drucker gave us in management, the science of management, that I started Echelon Management. And since 1990, I've worked with over 300 clients in the last 30 years. About 60 plus have been ag-related. But it's been an eclectic mix of almost every industry, military, government even, but mostly businesses that are 8 and 9 figure in size.
I'm sure that businesses perhaps are somewhat the same regardless of industry, but let's focus on agriculture since that's what we're doing here for a moment. Individual farms tend to be, we all have commodities in a sense, but our decision-making shouldn't be that way. I'd like you to start off by just talking about what are some of the things you see from an outsider's perspective that we as farm and agribusiness owners perhaps don't do so well that we should be thinking about, and then we'll get into some of the tools that we can use.
So even a farm needs to think more strategically. Most farmers have not one business, but three or more. So many of the farmers in this conference here, I have talked about how they have a trucking business, they have a custom business, they have another, a product business, and they have their grain business. But there was a fellow right there that shared with me, he had 4 different businesses, but they weren't different P&Ls, and they should be. They didn't have uniquely identified strategies, and they should. So each of those businesses need to be managed and innovated differently. So in the grain business, and the key to strategy is a combination of vision, focus, and divergence. Every business unit needs a vision. Where do you ideally see it in 10 years, 3 years, but out in the distance enough where it's a dynamically different business? And you want to codify that, write that down, share that with everybody that's on your team, all your advisors, the family, etc. For each of your business units, a unique vision. Yeah, you may have an overriding vision for the farm as a whole and all the businesses that are under that umbrella, but a unique vision for each one. Number 2, focus. Every business has a unique strategic focus. So in grain, it might be production and getting the production level up to a higher level. That would be a production-focused strategy, or what we call the primary source of leverage is getting the most bushel per acre out and ultimately net return per acre is what you're really going for. But how to get the ideal net return in grain might not be just more. It might be different. Now, this is where divergence comes into play. So most of the more successful farmers aren't just growing grain and selling it at the going rate. They're selling a unique type of grain or selling to a unique type of customer or locking in with a unique agreement. I was just working with the largest pork operation in the Midwest, and their unique approach is that they sell 95% of all their product from their 800,000 sow to one customer. And so that locks in their rate for years to come. They have a unique strength of being able to sell for that one customer other customers to bring into the system. So their unique ability to sell gives them an additional competitive advantage. But then they have other businesses. They have a real estate business, and there's a different strategy for that. A trucking business, a trucking business is a production-driven business usually. And when trucks sit empty or half full, there's ways to fill them up. There's ways to end the deadhead. And so that's a different strategy, but run it differently. Come up with that vision, come up with that unique strategy, and just thinking about it innovatively once a month is going to give you a greater return than all those other little tactical things you're doing. So strategic thinking is something that every business, but especially agriculture, needs to do and more of. Now, you asked about decision making. Mm-hmm. So that was one of the top things at this conference that a couple of dozen growers had said. I need tools to make more effective decisions when I'm making a major decision. I'm wringing my hands. So one of the tools we brought out that was very well received here the last couple of days was what's actually referred to as a decision approach that has more to do with leadership behavior than just the how of the decision making. It's more about the who. And so there was research done back in the 60s and 70s by Dr. Victor Vroom of Yale University. He has validated scientifically that if you use the right leadership behavior in executing a decision, your success of that decision will likely be 80% or higher. If you use the worst of the 5 approaches, it is likely that you will fail in that decision 80% of the time. So the five approaches are this, and they're all labeled to kind of explain what they are, but the A1 is alone, you act on your own to make the decision. You don't need any additional information. You have all that you need. You just need to make the decision. So that's the A1 approach. And for some decisions, it's appropriate. Other times, you need additional information from people, so it's A2, but you don't tell them what the decision is. It could be in regards to hiring or firing somebody, but you don't want to tell the person why you're asking, so that you don't want biased information. So A2 is appropriate at times. Now, C1 and C2 are when you're consulting with others, but you're telling them the decision. So C1 is where you're consulting with one person at a time. You're asking them for information in regards to this decision, and they're going to give you informed, insightful information because they know what the decision is, and it's appropriate that they know. So maybe it's the boss of the person you're thinking about letting go or moving up or whatever. That would be C1, one at a time. Now, there's other times there's a benefit to having a group in front of you and them cross-pollinating ideas. And so a C2 approach is where you share with two or more people the decision and ask questions, and you listen. But still, in C1 and C2, you make the final decision. So there's four approaches where you make the decision, but in very different ways, getting information to be more secure you're going the right direction. The final approach, though, is what's G2. The group makes the decision in a democratic approach. Far too many leaders either go to this direction or A1 to an extreme and thus aren't as successful. There are times you need buy-in. There are times you need innovation. There are times there are things you don't know that others need to be involved for that reason to make a more successful decision. So what Dr. Vroom proved, if you choose the right approach, A1, A2, C1, C2, or G2, you will far more likely, 80% likelihood of success with your decisions.
So what tool can I use to figure out which one of those is going to be my best decision, way to approach this decision?
You know, it's interesting. There's two tools. First of all, if you just look at that matrix of those five choices, mm-hmm. in your gut, you know 90% of the time. Now, and with the grower's world, you go to your spouse, and he or she's going to tell you exactly the best way to go, probably pretty accurately, and know who to go to if they know the operation well enough. So that would be phase one. Sometimes you have that confidant or a board of advisors you can go to and talk about this. But you'll know, and you'll pick the right way. Just think about it. The problem is too often we think, I got to do this now, or why don't I just give this to the team? And really, you should have been pulling the trigger, and it should have been a C2, not G2. The second tool to use, though, is a decision funnel. So there's four main things you need to list out and really analyze. At the top of the funnel, though, are the musts, the non-negotiables. In regards to the options of any decision, you want to list out what are the musts, the things that we must have or can't tolerate, whatever it may be. That's going to limit and eliminate some of the unnecessary options you have on the list. Then the wants. Prioritize your wants. That's going to bring the funnel down even tighter to fewer options. And once you've analyzed your musts and wants and you've prioritized the wants and kind of weighted them somewhat, you'll be down to a finer set, a smaller set of options. Now comes the decision time. And the final little analysis is analyzing and quantifying the risks, the potential risks, and the potential rewards. And so to make a decision more rationally, you want to think about what are all the possible risks and their impact to our organization if things go awry. So on a scale of 1 to 5, 1 being, few to nobody will even know about the problem that has come about, and that's no big deal. A -3 might be, the entire organization knows about it. It affects our morale, but we'll still work out of it. A -5 might mean you're on the front page of a business newspaper or, you're in Farm Journal for the wrong reasons. On the positive scale, a +1 might be there'd be a small benefit. +3 might be that this will add, significantly to our profitability. But a +5 might be an industry-changing result. And so if you do an analysis, the risks are no more than -3. That's still considerable, but the rewards are +5. You're talking about an industry game changer. That might be worth taking the risk. That's probably a C2 and involve the team and make sure they're all on board. And odds are, even if you hit rough waters, you're going to be able to keep them, bought in and helping to work your way back to safer water.
You have another effective tool that I think producers like in talking about roles and 12 roles and thinking about, okay, how do I work with those around me and kind of evaluating where we're at.
The role-focused 12 is a much better tool than the annual review. The goal of it is to get people aligned on the right objectives and aware of the right opportunities that, that both the manager and the managee can focus on to get the best result. Ideally, most of my clients use our Role Focus 12 document once a quarter to keep people on track, both the manager and the managee. But some of the questions it includes are things like, in the way you use it, and this is in both my books, High Growth Levers and Growth or Bust, we have the detailed full set of 12 questions in there. But the first question is, what are the top objectives of my manager or those to whom I report? And when you're the owner, you're going to answer that a little differently. You're going to talk about your bank, your spouse, your family, maybe your board of advisors if you have one. But for your managee, they're going to talk about what they think your top objectives are. Now you're going to self-correct with the next question. Now, again, you answer first as the manager. The managee answers second. So they kind of are getting coached on how to answer, but you're still going to find out the truth as to what they think. But then with the next question, it self-corrects. The second question is, what are my top objectives that are expected of me in my role? So you answer that first as the owner or the manager. Then the person to whom is reporting to you answers their version of that. And then the next question self-corrects. Now, you can coach them on their answer immediately. But in these 12 questions, we have other questions like, what are the top things that the company does or my unit does that most empower me? What are the things that my manager does that most help me? And that's good to hear. You're going to answer it first, and then they're going to answer it second. You're talking about your manager, your family, your bank, whatever it may be, things they do that do help. Then they're going to answer about you, and then you're going to help self-correct there. Now, the flip side, what are the things that the business does that most hinder me? What are the things that my manager does that most hinder me? Again, you answer first, then they answer, and you're becoming very aware of all the key things you need to be aware of. Now, it ends up on the last couple of questions. In relation to the above objectives we've discussed, what are the top projects and or activities I most need to focus on in the next 3 or 6 months? And so you answer that first, and that helps them to answer it themselves. And then they answer, and of course, you can self-correct. You can help coach them back to where they need to be. But it's a dialogue, not a one-way review. It's self-correcting. It's self-illuminating. And it's one of the ultimate, most powerful management tools you can implement. You can get that in either one of the books.
You mentioned the books there. They're bestsellers, and you've got so much that we can't get it all, of course, in this interview. But how's the best way for people to find those resources or find more about what you're doing and what you're teaching for businesses, and in this case, talking to farmers, too?
The easiest website address for me is growthorbust.com. And you can get a hold of me there, and I'll actually get you any of these tools. And with owners and CEOs, we always usually do a complimentary visioneering exercise, because there are literally dozens of tools we've accumulated in 30 years out there that whatever your problem is, there's something out there already that is a proven way to get over that hurdle. But I would wrap up with this. The other thing that too few people do effectively who run a business is visioneer. And just even 45 minutes on a virtual call, building a mind map of what you think the future potential could look like if all the stars align, along with a brief list of what the top constraints to your getting there are, along with a couple of the next most important actions to take. That's the kind of thing that basically has fueled my business growth, by just having that conversation. And something we're willing to do with anybody that's leading and employing people and needs to grow their business.
We'll check in with Mark from time to time to get his thoughts on best business practices. He brings the perspective of someone who works with the nation's top companies, and he understands agriculture. Good perspectives for each of us to implement in what we do. Thanks for listening to this week's show. Catch up with us on Facebook and be sure to follow my daily syndicated broadcast, American Countryside, on Facebook and at AmericanCountryside.com. And for those of you interested in helping small towns and rural America survive, get all of our tips and stories at TotalTownMakeover.com. There are plenty of great resources there. We'll be back next week with another edition of Farming the Countryside. The Farming the Countryside podcast is brought to you by Pivot Bioproven. Get what you paid for, the nitrogen that stays put, whether or not. Learn more at pivotbio.com.